I'd like to introduce our subject today. Today's reading is from Genesis chapter 1, and it's probably a reading we know well. What I'd like to say first is that it can seem like a slightly intimidating reading, but it really shouldn't be. It describes God in his creative work. And when we use the word God with a capital letter, we mean the one who created everything. So there's nothing controversial about that. The problem, for me at least, is that I know it's at the centre of a lot of arguments among Christians. And I'll start by telling you my position in those arguments, and then leave it. I have a science background, and I can't go along with what's called young earth creationism. So I'm not talking about that today. And consequently, I don't take some features in this chapter entirely literally. If you knew of my science background and you thought I was going to offer ammunition for the young earth position, I'm going to disappoint you, because I can't do that. If anyone wants to talk about this afterwards and tell me I'm wrong, I'll be available to be told I'm wrong. I've written an essay on the subject, if anyone's interested. I keep it online and I can give you a link to it. But I don't like getting into arguments, because those never solve anything. Even if you prefer a literal interpretation of every detail in the chapter, I hope you'll still be blessed by what I say about it today. Because what I want to say before we read is, all that science controversy isn't the main point. It's simply not what the chapter is meant to be about. And if we dive straight into that, we've completely missed what we're supposed to see here. And I hope today that we can all enjoy seeing important features in the Genesis account of God's creative work. So that's where I leave the controversy. And I'd like to get into the reading now, please. Genesis chapter 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. And God said, "Let there be light," and there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light day, and the darkness he called night. And there was evening, and there was morning, the first day. And God said, "Let there be a vault between the waters to separate water from water." So God made the vault and separated the water under the vault from the water above it. And it was so. God called the vault sky. And there was evening and there was morning, the second day. And God said, "Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place and let dry ground appear." And it was so. God called the dry ground land, and the gathered waters he called seas. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds." And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the third day. And God said, "Let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark sacred times, and days, and years, and let them be lights in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth." And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening and there was morning, the fourth day. And God said, "Let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the vault of the sky." So God created the great creatures of the sea, and every living thing with which the water teems and that moves about in it, according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said, "Be fruitful and increase in number, and fill the water in the seas, and let the birds increase on the earth." And there was evening and there was morning, the fifth day. And God said, "Let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, the livestock, the creatures that move along the ground, and the wild animals, each according to its kind." And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said, "Let us make mankind in our image, in our likeness, so that they may rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, over the livestock and all the wild animals, and over all the creatures that move along the ground." So God created mankind in his own image. In the image of God he created them. Male and female he created them. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish in the sea and the birds in the sky, and over every living creature that moves on the ground." Then God said, "I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to all the beasts of the earth, and all the birds in the sky, and all the creatures that move along the ground, everything that has the breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food." And it was so. God saw all that he'd made, and it was very good. And there was evening, and there was morning, the sixth day. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he'd been doing, so on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it, he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. I hope you enjoyed that reading. I'm sure that most of it was familiar. It's hard to know where to start in talking about it because it describes everything. Well, almost all ancient peoples had a creation story, and I'd like us first to see how this one stands out. The creation myth was a well-known form of literature, and in any ancient culture, it fulfilled several purposes. First of all, it had to be a good and entertaining story with satisfying structure, and I'm sure we all noticed the structure in that one. More importantly, it would lay the foundations for the religious beliefs of the society it was given to. So we see in this early realizations about the Lord God. It showed people also where they fit in, where they fitted into the world. There's everything that's made, and it will show me where I fit in and what I can expect in life and what my role is. The creation account in Genesis has some obvious similarities to other creation stories like that we know of, but also some striking differences, and in some points it's unique. It shows where everything came from, as such an account should, but it also shows things about God which he uniquely revealed to the Jews. And I'm sure you noticed that it makes clear that there is one God. There is one God who was responsible for making all of this. Almost all other cultures described many gods, among which they might have a favourite one. And these gods, with small g, might be very powerful, but they were usually seen as part of the creation, not outside it, not transcendent, as theologians would say. These gods were usually not all-powerful and all-knowing either. They were more like people with special powers, like maybe modern superheroes, or in some cases supervillains even, because they weren't all good. But Genesis describes God existing before anything else, before anything else even has form, and creating everything there is out of nothing at all. He didn't have to work in any way to do this. His power is just to say, let there be such and such, and there is, because that's what he chooses. Other creation myths describe their multiple gods creating the world out of very strange materials, or even body parts of some of the other gods. They always need raw materials to work on, and their work is often imperfect. Did you notice how many times God saw that it was good, what he'd created in that account? I'll give you one example. In Norse mythology, the dark and silent abyss Ginnungagap, apologies if you know that that's wrong, between the fire, Muspelheim, and the ice, Niflheim, the fire melted the ice, and the drops melting from the ice formed Ymir, a destructive giant. And then the frost continued to melt, and a cow, Auðumla, I think, emerged from the ice. She nourished Ymir the giant with her milk and also licked the ice, and she slowly uncovered Buri, the first of the gods. Later on, Odin, that we've probably heard of, was his grandson. But Odin and his brothers slew the giant, Ymir, and built the world from his corpse, using various parts of him to make different features. Then they formed the first man and woman, Ask and Embla, and built a fence around their dwelling place, Midgard, to protect them from the giants. The picture in Genesis of one transcendent God creating everything out of nothing by his own power and wisdom is quite a contrast to stories like that, isn't it? In fact, one thing Genesis offers us, if we want to do theology, is the teleological argument for believing in God. Created things, it said, show us something of what the Creator is like. And if the creation is good, so is the Creator. And that's expanded on a lot in both the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I won't read all these now, but there's a passage from Psalm 19 there, and there's Romans chapter 1 verse 20 telling us that since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made. You can learn about God from what he has made. Well then, why is there any of that argument that I touched on earlier? I think what goes wrong is this. When we meet the phrase, the heavens and the earth, we are misled into thinking of a picture like this. It's wonderful to have pictures like this these days and to have seen the earth from space and to see wonderful pictures from astronomy. But that phrase, the heavens and the earth, makes us immediately think of the globe Earth floating in space, usually with brightly coloured nebulae rather than just mostly black. And we think, this is going to be about astronomy and cosmology then. It will have things to tell us about science. That's not the reaction that people at the time of the writing of Genesis would have had from that phrase. And I think a better translation would be the sky and the landscape, what one of us sees from our individual point of view. This chapter shows us, as I said, where we fit in to what God has made and what it looks like to us, what our situation and role is. In verse 16, it said, he also made the stars, and that's a huge temptation to me to start talking about astronomy, as you probably realise, but I've got to avoid that today, because that's not what the chapter is about. I could go on and on about how enormous stars and galaxies are, and how the numbers of them are mind-boggling, but from the perspective of a created being here, stars don't look huge, they're distant. They're only seen at night, and they're not particularly important to me. And that's the perspective they get in Genesis as well. Okay, digging in a little deeper, there's some structure to the chapter. You would have noticed the morning and evening and morning straight away, but there's structure which isn't immediately obvious, and I've tried to indicate it here. Days 1 to 3 have in mind the formation of what you might call the environment, the sky, the sea, and the land. And they're left fairly undetailed at that point. But days 4 to 6 revisit those environments and fill those settings with the things that occupy them. And by the way, that explains the puzzle about why there are three evenings and mornings before the sun is even made. It's the evening and morning is supposed to be a kind of a picture frame for various scenes in what's going on. It's a word picture showing the whole thing at once. So the overview we're being given is the organisation into three domains and how they're filled with appropriate things and creatures. And another thing happens at the same time. Along the way, almost everything that people can be tempted to worship in God's place is in the list as something that God has actually created, so it's obviously foolish to worship it. That was an important feature of this account for the Jews. The sky, the sun and moon, great creatures, even ourselves, they're all shown to be things that God made out of nothing. Their origin is in his will. He is responsible for their existence. And it's a huge mistake to put any of them in his place. I could go on into lots more detail, but probably shouldn't. But I'll just take one. The sea is an interesting image all through the Bible. You can Google it, or you can go on a searchable Bible and look for sea. In verse 2 there, the waters were unformed and chaotic. And that means dangerous and destructive. God has to subdue them and impose form on them. And in verse 9, he does that. The seas are removed from the land, making our kind of life impossible. All through the Old Testament, this carries on. And, for example, in Psalm 74, I recommend it for later, the sea is often threatening. It contains great sea monsters. So in the New Testament, when Jesus calmed the storm, he was reasserting God's authority over that part of the creation. Later on, in Revelation chapter 4, we see a glassy, clear sea, completely without waves, before the throne of God in his presence. In Revelation 13, that goes wrong and a terrifying beast comes out of the sea. But in Revelation 21, when everything's over, there's finally no more sea. The chaos is completely tamed and removed at last. There are other features from Genesis that you can trace right through the Bible if you want to. I won't go into that now. Several times in that account, God said, "Be fruitful and multiply." That's his emphasis in this creation. There's a way for it to work right. There's a proper way for it to function. We are in charge of it now, as we read. And we disturb it, and we drive things into extinction or mess it up at our own peril. And I think that in recent years we're noticing this more and more. God pronounces his creation very good at the end himself. Did you notice he said it was good all the way through? And then at the end, when it was complete, the phrase is very good. And I think we can agree with that. It's amazing when you learn anything about biology or geology or astronomy. It's fantastic. It's awe-inspiring. We can agree that God's creation is very good. Sometimes we notice things that aren't so good. Diseases exist. Disasters occur. And that's a reminder to us that the creation now isn't how it should be. It's not how God originated it and intends it. But we are promised in the New Testament that it will be restored. This is Romans chapter 8. The creation waits in eager expectation for the children of God to be revealed. For the creation was subjected to frustration, not by its own choice, but by the will of the one who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be liberated from its bondage to decay and brought into the freedom and glory of the children of God. If you think that the creation is awe-inspiring and amazing in many ways, you haven't seen anything yet, is the message of that, I think. But that phrase, the children of God, brings us back to what I said before, that the account would show us not only what God has made and how it works, perhaps, but also where we fit into it. And the most striking thing about human beings is that we're made in the image of God. So I guess we need to think about what that means for a conclusion. It doesn't simply mean we look like him, obviously, because he's invisible and we all look different. It doesn't mean, therefore, that we're like him in physical characteristics. It's important to notice that male and female are both created in God's image in that chapter. So what does it mean? One notable feature, I think, one thing that it does mean, is that we like making things. That's kind of a universal human trait. We bear the image of the creator of everything. J.R.R. Tolkien has one of his characters saying to the creator, "The making of things is in my heart, from my own making by thee." And that's what we're all like. So if you're looking around, I don't know, an engineer or a bricklayer, or an artist, or you like knitting, or even playing Minecraft, that's because you bear the image of the Creator, and because you're in his image, you create too. We're also placed in authority. Maybe that wasn't so obvious in ancient times, in the times when people were wandering and keeping herds of goats and things like this, but now technology has made our control of the world complete when we exercise it properly. That doesn't mean we can do whatever we like. We're responsible for the condition of the world we have dominion over. And one of the things that God will eventually judge is how well we've looked after our bit, I think. We know good from evil, which other creatures maybe don't. God pronounced his creation good. We're in his image and we can recognise good too. This I think is where we're different from most animals. If a tiger eats you, it's not because it's an evil tiger, it's just being a tiger. Okay, that's how it is. But we can recognise good and evil in our own actions. It has to be said that our perception of good and evil has been warped by sin, and that will, I take it, be next week in the chapter where Adam and Eve are tempted by the knowledge of good and evil. Another translation problem here, that word knowledge might be better translated as experience. They chose to experience good and evil, thinking that they wouldn't know the difference otherwise. And now people insist on mixing up evil and good, or rationalise that evil is good, or deny that there's any difference at all because of sin. We can still know the difference by God's help. And there is the gospel, because God's help extends to becoming one of us, dying because of sin and setting us free from its power. Think about it. In doing that, he has created himself in our image. That's what the incarnation means. That's a rather complicated reversal of the situation, isn't it? It's probably more complicated than I can go into now. But I'll just mention that Jesus, in John chapter 5, claims complete authority over all this. He appears to contradict the last verse we read about God resting from his work. He said, "My Father is working still, and I am working." That was John chapter 5, verse 17. That was deliberate. He told the Jews that their understanding of their creation account was wrong. My Father is working still, and I am working. And we're meant to think about why he said that. Well, the conclusion then is, I think any sermon has to pass the so what test. We need to learn not only about God and what he does, but about ourselves and how we should live. And we have seen that, I think, when we thought of being made in his image. To be in his image, acknowledging him and our place in his creation, is important. Live up to the image of him that we have. We make things because he creates. We need to strive to make things well so that afterwards we can see that what we've done is good, just as he did in that creation account. And that applies most obviously to our work if we're in employment, but it can extend to everything we do. We need to take responsibility generally for the environment and also for things in the world that we have control over on a smaller scale. We need to recognise good and evil and choose good and choose to do good. We human beings are so good at rationalising, explaining to ourselves that whatever we happen to want is good and we should do it. That's one of our main skills, I would say. And lastly, we need to put our faith in Christ, who is God incarnate. That's God made in our image, become one of us. And therefore, we need the realization that the whole point of being a Christian is to become gradually like him, showing his love to others, and making the image of God we bear clearer and more evident.